Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot. I'm Max, and I'm joined today here in the studio by Rory. And this week, we're focusing on a political intervention that has sent shockwaves through Westminster. Tony Blair is back. Not to launch a comeback, not to endorse a leadership challenge, but to deliver a warning. A warning that Labour risks misreading the country. A warning that voters may be turning against parts of the political consensus on net zero, economic growth, and state reform. And a warning that unless Labour adapts, parties such as Reform UK could become a far greater threat than many in Westminster currently believe. Today, we're looking beyond the headlines and asking, is Tony Blair right? Because this isn't really about Blair. It's about whether Britain's political centre has correctly understood what voters want, especially after events such as Brexit, the COVID pandemic, the cost of living crisis, and the rise of populism. Today we'll examine net zero, economic growth, immigration, state reform, Reform UK, and Labour's future electoral coalition. So let's get into it. So, Rory, hello. Welcome to the studio.
Great to be back.
Well, as I've already mentioned in the introduction, for those listening, we're going to be talking about the comments of Tony Blair. But if we look at the context, the background information to what's just happened, of course, Labour's had a lot of polling difficulties, especially after the local council elections. They were completely almost not decimated, but Reform really gained ground on them. And this really showed a lot of members of the Labour Party that the leadership of Keir Starmer was not what they required, really. And of course, it caused many Labour MPs to resign. And Wes Streeting himself announced that in the event of a leadership challenge, he would run. And his main idea was around rejoining the EU. And of course, Andy Burnham has spoken about not wanting to be drawn back into this conundrum involving Brexit and the EU as well. But if we look at Tony Blair's concern, it's that Labour is becoming more reactive to the difficulties that the country is facing instead of being strategic and having this model and plan. I mean, we've spoken on the podcast before about our frustration, really, that Labour's had 15 years to plan what they're going to do. Rory, don't, and of course, you know this.
Of course I have.
And if we think about the way that they've come into power and they haven't really made a lot of change, and then the different issues arise, Mandelson, cost of living, Iran war, and they're becoming more reactionary instead of actually thinking about the long term, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, 100%.
And if you think about Tony Blair as well, obviously very credible ex-prime minister.
Yeah.
Do you think that Keir Starmer should be thinking to really change what he's doing now and get the support back of voters, especially since Tony Blair is such an esteemed member in the world of politics?
I think there's a lot of respect for Tony Blair. Not maybe less for his political decisions, but as far as winning elections, he's an electoral machine in himself. I mean, he brought the Labour Party, which had been out of government for 18 years, to win two landslide victories and a majority victory, and he served for more than 10 years as Prime Minister. So there's obviously a lot of credibility that comes with him. And he's the real, I think he's the only modern example, well, he is the only modern example, bar Keir Starmer himself, of actually someone who's electable. I'd say, maybe not in Keir Starmer's case, but particularly for him, he actually brings enthusiasm to the electorate. And I think Keir Starmer hasn't done that. But I think what is very important to note is that the world that we are living in 2026 is a far different world from that.
Than what it was when he was
from when he was Prime Minister between 1997 and 2007. So that's more than 20 years ago. The world's changed. I think the politics in this country has changed. I mean, the Greens were not really a political force at all.
Well, Reform weren't.
The Greens didn't even have an MP back then. They only won it in 2010. Reform weren't even a force. UKIP wasn't really a force back. Actually, it was maybe slightly a force. I mean, the BNP, the British National Party, which was the almost far-right party that preceded it, or filled that sort of space before UKIP came along as a bit more moderate. They existed, but Blair existed in a time frame where actually the Liberal Democrats were quite a big party and they were getting near to being in contention for actually leading a government. So the electorate back then was far more, I want to say, centrist, far more kind of, well, less polarised than it is today. I mean, you're seeing two huge extremes between democratic socialists and right-wing populists. Well, yeah.
It's quite very divided in terms of the different parties that people can vote for now and obviously the support that each of the different parties have, as in it's quite divided now, especially because of the death of two-party politics.
Yeah, exactly.
As you would say.
But I think Blair has charisma where Keir Starmer, importantly, does not. And I think that in this new age of social media and technology, having charisma is far more important, especially as far as publication is concerned, and you didn't really have that, or not as much as an effect in, what, the early 2000s. So I think the Keir Starmer has his own weakness, but that's being compounded by the fact that...
Well, scandal after scandal.
Well, scandal after scandal, it, yeah. But the weakness of not having any charisma is...
He is very dry, as in he comes
well, yes,
across
I mean,
as not
well,
particularly
obviously,
interesting.
But as far, but like people would know that far easier. Or in an age where that's actually really important, having charisma and good social skills and excitement and bringing enthusiasm to the electorate. Keir Starmer just doesn't have that. I think that's one part of Keir Starmer's problem.
Yeah, especially when, I'm not like criticising, I'm just adding on. Especially when he delivers, he says, I'm going to fight for this job. But where's the enthusiasm? Show that you want this job. Show the public that you're willing to change.
Even the policy, even all his press conferences, I mean, there's no kind of, a lot of commentators are saying that they could almost fall asleep when he's talking. Like he has no conversation skills, but he can't really, I think fundamentally he can't present his policies or his ideology or his feelings in an effective way that can grasp the attention of the electorate. I think that's one half of his problems. I think the other half of his problems is the fact that actually the space that he's occupying now of kind of almost centre-left, like centrism, but trying to appeal to the left-wing and right-wing fringes of different parties, I think it's just, it doesn't practically come together. And I think he's now in a really awkward position where one thing he does actually really upsets another group of people, and he can't really kind of almost balance with the seesaw of the Labour Party or the wider British electorate. So I think that is another problem of Keir Starmer's premiership. And you've seen a lot of that criticism that Blair has put through in his essay that he published a few days ago. And that has largely been a criticism of the policy elements and the more political strategic errors that Keir Starmer has had. I know you'll ask me this, but I think he represents what a lot of the country thinks. And I think actually he says this from a almost opposition-like conservative perspective. I mean, I saw Jacob Rees-Mogg. I watched some of his almost essay videos. And one of them was on Tony Blair. And actually he referred to him as Tory Blair. Like these are quite... Well, these are the sort of attack lines that probably like the likes of the conservatives or maybe even some elements of Reform UK would put out in almost criticism of Keir Starmer. So I think he raises good points that a lot of people almost agree with, I agree with, but I think he's, in doing that, I think he's almost moving himself from an insider, almost sort of advisory, like Labour perspective to an almost outsider, almost critical perspective of the government. So I think in that respect, he's probably lost a little bit of credibility.
I think he's every right though, don't you think? Especially to criticise the Labour government. I mean, obviously he's gone public with it. And I think when he talks about how Labour do not need a change of leader, but a change of policy. I mean, I only partly agree with that because I think a change of leader is required because the leader's not charismatic enough. And I think a change of policy is required because, the country's going downhill. There's no growth, but economic growth. But I don't think that bringing in a new leader won't bring different policies it only depends really on the leader, because it's in Labour's DNA really to not cut taxes or not change this, because that's the traditional model of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
And really, if they change that, they would either go even more, well, they could go more far left and appeal to the Greens, or they could even move more to the centre, and then they're going to lose even more voters. So it's quite a conundrum,
I think, actually, you actually raise a very good point. But also, as far as like fundamental, almost core values of the Labour Party, I think there's a real almost parallel between 2020 and maybe 2019 and 1992. I mean, Labour more, maybe 1992, Labour were on course to win the election. Most people predicted, even the exit poll predicted, to be a hung parliament. Maybe the Conservatives would be slightly ahead, but the polls had put Labour ahead for quite a while. And actually the Tories came out of that with the majority government. And I think that was a real almost killer blow to the almost democratic socialist, well, let me get rid of this democratic, but the real socialist almost instincts and almost roots of the Labour Party. And you saw Tony Blair uproot that in 1994, I want to say, when he took over as Labour leader.
Yeah.
John Smith died.
Yeah.
And then 3 years later, he delivered a landslide victory for the Labour Party, maybe in part to some Conservative failures.
But he obviously knows how to win votes, isn't he?
I think an interesting thing about Blair, or the key difference between Blair and Starmer, particularly in their election victories, is that the 1997 election was more of a victory for Labour rather than a defeat for the Conservatives.
Tories, yeah.
And you saw an exact opposite for that in 2024.
2024 was all about people not wanting to vote for the Tories.
I think 1997 was driven by excitement and enthusiasm for Tony Blair, whereas in 2024 it was a resentment and a disgust.
Well, yeah, it was like a rejuvenated, like fresh version of the Labour Party.
And that was new Labour.
2024 was all about not voting for the Conservatives.
Or having a change. Yeah, exactly. So they've tried to do these same lines. But I think the DNA of the party, like you mentioned, there are some core instincts of it. But you saw in 1994 when Tony Blair took over, he completely uprooted that and changed it. So I think it can be done. He did it.
Yeah.
And he won three times. So one of which, when he was leading government in a very unpopular war that arguably he somewhat instigated or started, because I mean, I don't know. It's controversial. We will not get into the Iraq war.
We'll leave that for another day.
But I think it is, I won't say convenient, but I think it's not satisfying, but I don't know what the word is, but almost as if it's almost in his kind of nature to almost challenge the DNA and the core instincts and the core values of the Labour Party, because that's what he did in 1994. So I don't think it's very surprising from Tony Blair to actually be doing this, to criticise the current direction of the party, because realistically that's sort of what he did in 1994. Yeah.
What do you think Keir Starmer's learning from Gordon Brown? I mean,
oh God!
What do you think behind that appointment? Would you say, as in, do you think that was? Do you think Keir Starmer wants to veer more to the left? Do you think that was the right appointment to bring in?
As far as I'm aware, Gordon Brown's new role is almost international economic cooperation, and I can see the sense behind it. Obviously, in 2008, the financial crisis came along. Gordon Brown then initiated this London almost summit, I think that's what they called it. All the major leaders from the, I think the G20, but you had like China, most of East Asia, America, Canada, a lot of European countries, basically all the developed countries in the world came to London, and they all signed these almost economic pacts to almost bear this strain of the 2008 financial crisis, and that is almost that's what he did, and that was a remarkable success for him when he bailed out all the banks and he collectively injected, I think, £1 trillion or $1 trillion into the global economy, and that really brought the economy out of the ditch. But I think this appointment really plays to his strength, because fundamentally in 2008 he instigated global economic cooperation, and that's sort of his role right now. So I can see the sense behind it, and I can see the logic behind it. But I think the appointment. I'm actually quite confused as far as why Gordon Brown was brought back. He is not very critical of Keir Starmer in the sense, in the way that like Tony Blair was in his essay. And I mean, I haven't really seen a lot of like, you know, anti-Starmerite policy from, or not policy, but rhetoric from Gordon Brown, given, even though he's sort of, or in the Blair-Brown relationship, he was very much the, almost representing the more traditional Labour elements, particularly at the end of Blair's time in office. So
yeah.
I don't really see why Brown was, I don't know, I didn't see the economic, or not the economic, sorry, the political Labour almost,
I think it's just, as an motivation. I think it's just in terms of an advisory sense. I mean, as you mentioned before,
but I don't think
with with the financial crisis as well. You've spoken about how he's injected three trillion US dollars into
a trillion.
You said sorry, and well, how he handled it quite well. You're talking about how he was inviting the developed countries to London.
Yeah,
I think Keir Starmer is not really looking for Gordon Brown to ask for almost a change in policy, but just, I think, almost a way to, not emotional support, but help him.
What, bring him into the circle almost?
Yeah, well, to help him handle the, I mean, I think Keir Starmer's probably quite worried. I mean, anyone would be if Andy Burnham, especially with the Makerfield by-election coming up and the almost like a coronation, really.
Yeah.
If Andy Burnham ends up winning that election, will Keir Starmer stand in the leadership contest, or could he go with dignity? Roy, do you think? Do you think he'll go, or do you think he'll stand? Because personally, I think the state he's in now, and I think he's had enough time to implement his policies. He hasn't done it well enough. It's time for him to go without embarrassing himself, really. Because
yeah,
to be honest, I think he gets swept aside by Burnham and then.
Well, as far as your first question, as far as will he stand in the election, I think he will. I think he's slightly annoying in the sense that he won't go down without a fight. But interestingly enough, I don't think that fight's going to be very strong. I think it'll be a fight out of dignity. He won't go graciously. I think it'll be a fight for self-dignity and almost kind of, I don't know. I don't think he want. I think there's a, not an emotional kind of sense, but I think he'd feel almost guilty if he decided to step down without a fight. And I don't know, Burnham or Streeting comes in like wrecks the country as if it's not already wrecked already. But I think that he will lose that election. I don't think he should stand. I think, if he really cared about the country,
he would
about the country, he would have resigned.
My ages ago, yeah.
He would have resigned when the Manderson files came out. Or
maybe he would have even resigned after the local
elections.
Well,
he would have resigned after the local elections.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the polls. Oh, well, the polls don't represent the elections. Then you look at the local elections. Oh, well, it's just an anti-government vote. It always happens. No, you don't lose 1,500 councillors. That's not how local elections work. You probably lose, I don't know, on a bad night, you'd probably lose 500 councillors here and there.
Yeah, not
not
thousands.
Triple that.
Yeah.
So I think he's being extremely naive to the point he's actually quite annoying and maybe even slightly off-putting. But I think there is a, I think he will stand that election. He will not get far. I think it'll become a, let's look at who's standing. Wes Streeting is clearly standing based on whatever stupid press conference he gave a few weeks ago.
Yes.
I don't think Angela Rayner will stand.
No, she won't. She'll,
she's backed, I think she's backed Burnham. And I think she'll be,
She wants a job in his government, really. If
she wants to get, I think she,
she wants a top
job. I think
job.
I respect what she's doing in the sense that she isn't,
you're
rushing,
jumping the gun.
She isn't,
yeah,
rushing to, like, I would, and I have criticism of Rishi Sunak, not policy wise, but I don't think he should have become Prime Minister when the country was in economic freefall. Yes, he was Chancellor.
Because he easily could have been a good Prime Minister when we weren't in such a terrible mess.
You wasted him. Yeah. Basically, that's my grievance of actually putting him in. I think he would have been an excellent opposition leader, and I think he would have probably won a majority because he was very politically popular by the time he left government, and he didn't really hold a lot of baggage other than maybe the furlough scheme. But even that was very popular because it kept people in jobs and it kept the economy afloat. Maybe Partygate, but that's my little thought. But I think the same is true for Angela Rayner. I think she's currently stuck in a bit of a crisis. No, well, not in a crisis, but well, she's
apparently
just
resolved.
She's just cleared her tax scandal.
Still got
baggage, she did it a few
though.
Weeks ago. But I think it. I think if she, I don't know, gave it 2 or 3 years, let Burnham. I don't know what's going to happen to Burnham. But fate knows, or West Streeting. But let's just say that maybe the ball comes out of the scrum again. Then she'll be in a much stronger position.
Yeah, but
especially
Angela Rayner,
if she's a cabinet secretary, she can actually point to things she's done. Because currently she was, well, not currently,
housing.
But as of thus far in Labour's term, she's only served as housing secretary. And I don't think we can find any houses in the country that have been built under a Labour government or legislation. I mean, I think she's focused. I think the main problem that they identified as far as her brief in the manifesto was housing. But I think she's focused far more on local government, which is still in her job. But I don't think she's really given as much emphasis to housing that Labour promised in the manifesto in 2024. I think that some of their, I mean, a lot of their council rejigging has been very controversial, particularly in the home counties in Anglia or East Anglia. But, and obviously they got challenged on this by the courts and they lost it, and that was quite embarrassing for them. But I don't think she can't really go around waving all her successes. And I think she'll carry baggage, but I think it'll weigh her down and it will really, I think fundamentally, and the main almost point I'm trying to make is that she'll enter Downing Street with far less political capital if she did it now than she would if maybe she decided to run for it for maybe 2 or 3 years when either Burnham stands down or there's like a leadership election, because she's very popular among Labour circles.
Yeah.
But I don't think she's that popular enough yet with the public to properly...
I mean, if Burnham wins, she could easily get a job in his cabinet. I mean,
she's
back. She wouldn't get a job in West Streeting's cabinet. Like, never. That's never
happening. She might.
Really?
I think she might.
As what would you say?
Well, I don't think Streeting's going to become Prime Minister. He won't.
Okay, well, let's say Burnham doesn't win the by-election then.
Well,
which is what, just to clarify, what you said in the last episode.
I think he will. Very slightly. Did I say in the last episode I didn't think he wouldn't?
You said he wouldn't win.
Okay, well, I've changed my mind.
Okay, you
it's
changed
a very
mind.
Tight race.
Okay,
tight
that's
race.
Fine, yeah. So, okay, so you think he's going to win, yeah.
But I think that's...
So even if Burnham wins, do you think Streeting's going to run?
Yeah, he will.
But there's no... No one's going to vote... No, and I'm sorry to Wes, but people are going to vote...
Don't be sorry to a health secretary.
People are going to vote for Andy Burnham.
Yeah.
So the
Labour poll put West Streeting at 6%.
He should wait.
Six.
He should wait.
94% of the party are against him. 94.
He should do an Angela Rayner and wait.
I think he's always said, if there's a leadership election...
Well, he said, I'm going to stand. Okay, fine. But if Burnham doesn't win... Okay, stand. Go on and take your chance. If he wins... Don't stand. It could be humiliating.
Some people, I think you saw a lot in the Tory election in 2022. A lot of people, and actually maybe in, I think a good example of the Tory leadership election 2024. In 2022, a lot of people were on the field, but I think you saw in 2024 that actually a lot of the candidates who stood, I think how many, there were six of them, and initially all but two got shadow cabinet roles. And then James Cleverly, the fifth one, got brought back in.
I think James Cleverly is a very, very good politician.
Well,
I really like James Cleverly.
I very like James Cleverly as well.
I think Kemi Badenoch wasn't the leader of the Conservative Party, I'd have him. I'd have him any day.
Well, I'd have a lot of Conservatives as my leadership of the Conservative Party. I have a lot of Conservatives as my Prime Minister as well. But that's beside the point. I think that West Streeting, I don't think he will become Prime Minister. I think the point I'm trying to make is that he'll stand knowing that he will not win, or the odds are very much stacked against him, but that actually by standing, he almost gets a shadow cabinet brief, or a cabinet brief in this case. Because that's what happened in 2022, that's what happened in 2024. maybe he's going to think, oh, well, the Tories did it.
Yeah,
maybe
so he I'm could get a shadow luck. Role, yeah.
But I think it's less about winning the crown. It's more about securing a good spot, because almost they're almost not entitled, but it's general kind of, not practical, but there's a good practice of giving your opponents seats in your cabinet. And that's just been, maybe that's a Tory trend, maybe it's not Labour. I mean, Labour haven't had a leadership election since, what, 2019? That's like nearly 7 years ago. That's crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think Streeting will win that election.
Okay. Okay, so now if we're going to move on to our next, not like segment, but mini segment, we move back to Tony Blair's comments. And I want to talk about the argument around net zero, because that's become something that Ed Miliband has obviously endorsed quite a lot as the energy secretary. And Tony Blair's spoken about how voters obviously support this idea of climate action, especially because of the issues that are facing the world right now.
Yeah.
But voters don't support this idea of economic sacrifice in that sense. And prioritising clean energy over cheap energy, especially if it, okay, so in a, let's think about the cost of living crisis now. Okay, people are struggling to pay their bills, energy, gas, okay, and there's so much of a push for clean and renewable energy that people are almost struggling to be able to,
yeah,
you know, afford this. Do you think that net zero is actually an achievable goal and should be prioritized now, or should be almost worked towards as long-term and cheaper, maybe short-term energy should be prioritized now?
So answering your first question, do I think it's achievable? By ourselves, definitely not. I mean, the emissions that we emit is less than 1%. So if we, as a country, went net zero, the carbon dioxide in our air would only go down 1%. Maximum, and actually it may even increase considering the rate that other countries are going at. So it will make meaningless difference. Do I think that we should prioritize clean energy over cheap energy? At times of uncertainty, like now, we've got an Iran war, we've got a Ukraine war, I do not think that we should be taking risks as far as green energy is concerned with our energy deposits and or oil legislation. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm very much a supporter of net zero. I think it's a, or climate change. I recognise climate change and I see that it is a problem and we should do something about it. And my ambition for the country is that we can eventually reach net zero. I just don't think now is, I think now is not practically the time to do it.
Yeah.
You've got really high energy prices. The country wants cheaper energy. I mean, fuel prices going through the roof. You've got a cost of living crisis. People have to choose between heating their homes and buying food. Now is not the time to almost put in the hard work. I think that time was like 2010s when there was not a lot of conflict. I mean, the main oil that we import nowadays is from the North Sea. Not from Scotland, but from Norway. But we also get oil from, obviously, we used to get a lot from Russia. We have, well, now the government is trying to buy a Russian oil, which I'm totally against. I think there are two sides of the coin there. But we also get, the point is, we get a lot of oil from the Middle East as well. And obviously, the Strait of Hormuz is closed, so we can't do that.
It's not very helpful.
I think the government's net zero policy, particularly with their oil policy and drilling in the North Sea, I think is absolutely abysmal, quite stupid, and like heads in your hand on your heads kind of moment, or your head in your hands moment. I think it is so stupid that A, you're taxing people for having, or you're going to tax people for driving fossil fuel powered cars, but also the fact that you're not only not allowing Scottish oil refineries to drill in the North Sea, but instead of, like, it's so stupid because, like, what you're trying to do? Because you're banning drilling oil in the North Sea. You're not letting Scottish industry drill in the North Sea. But at the same time, you're paying Norwegians to drill in the North Sea, and you're just buying oil off them.
Off them, yeah.
In the same space that otherwise Scottish oil driller or manufacturers or drillers, I don't know what you call them, would do. So that is, like, completely stupid. I do not get it. It actually makes me, I don't know, slightly angry, the fact that, I don't know, it's not being talked about enough. So I think we should be allowing to drill in the North Sea, 100%. But...
Well, it's a massive energy shortage in oil.
Like,
we definitely need to be doing that.
Which is equally as disgusting and, like, disgusting.
It's about Russia.
As, well, yeah. You're watering down restrictions on Russia, so you're going to...
I mean, that's not morally correct in any way, especially with the war in Ukraine.
Okay, so there are two parts of this. Yeah. A, you're paying, or you're paying nations that pay Russia to buy oil, and they're using that money to fund their illegal war in Ukraine by killing innocent children and Ukrainians and Ukrainian soldiers. Maybe they're not as innocent, but still, you're arming or you're helping an armed country fight a war that you're against. That doesn't make any sense.
Which completely goes against everything the UK stands for in that sense.
Exactly. Yeah. But you'd rather do that option than let your own workers
drill in the North Sea
to flood the market
It's really bizarre. It's bizarre.
It is stupid. It is absolutely stupid. And it's just, like, stupid to the point where it's actually kind of disgusting. And you can't really understand their trail of thought. And I think it really does sum up this government, that they are so driven by their own party instincts, and they want to be green, they want to be really nice and vegan and climate friendly. But, like, you have to read the room. You've got to read the country. Keir Starmer came into Parliament, or he didn't come to Parliament, he came to be Prime Minister, saying that he put country before party.
He hasn't done any of that.
Well, no, he's put his party before country. He's putting his own political ideology ahead of the bills of working people across the country. That's just so stupid.
Like, I mean, especially since the Labour Party stands for protecting working people. They haven't done a very good job of that. Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And I want to say that I'm surprised, but let's be realistic. This is an absolutely... I don't want to be, like... I don't want to throw out any expletives here, but it's a pretty... Pretty rubbish government. And I think, I don't know, it just makes me really quite angry. I don't know why. It's so stupid.
Well, it's not efficient in any way, is it? I mean, you could be doing it yourself instead of either buying it off other people or funding an illegal war.
You're buying off other people, but, like, I mean, also, you have to pay, you have to use oil to actually, like, what do you think? How do you think you get your oil? Like, the ships also run on oil, so you're actually using even more oil. You're paying even more money. And you're not letting British people get jobs. Like, that's such a, like, I don't know, it's like the worst deal you can get. I don't know, it's so stupid.
Yeah, so I think Ed Miliband really needs to not tear up the plan about net zero and everything, but just prioritise the working people. We even chat with Rachel Reeves about what they're going to do about it. I mean, all I saw that she was doing was lowering VAT on summer activities.
Oh, yeah. You're saving...
Oh, well done. You lowered VAT on one thing. That was not even what we needed.
Activities. Do you know how much it costs? I think it saves... I don't know. I want to get the figure up here. But it saves less than £10 for each person. I mean, that might be a lot of money. But over a year, yeah. I'll give you £10 back. Now give me your vote. Well, it's so stupid. I don't understand that. But I'll get you the real fact up here because I did see it. But yeah, you just keep talking in the meantime when I find this stat. And I'll share it with you. Or just bear with me 1 second.
So, while Rory is... typing, I'm just going to fill the void. So if we look at this idea of Blairism versus Starmerism, now this is where it becomes quite interesting, because of course Blair's Britain was around this idea of a rejuvenated, fresh, new Labour. Starmer's thinking about creating a stronger state and really standing up for workers' rights, when really how can he be standing up for workers' rights when you have junior doctors still going on strike? You have railway workers still going on strike. Think about the devastating effects that's going to have on the country. Think about what is happening now with them increasing, well, not increasing national insurance, but the fact that they won't cut national insurance. The levels of unemployment are increasing more in the country. There are more NEETs, as you have it, not in employment, education or teaching. And that is just leading to a lot of the graduates, they just can't get a job. And the narrative that the Conservative Party are offering about cutting national insurance, I think, is a perfectly valid one. Because if you cut national insurance, businesses have the capacity to hire more people. So in theory, there's less unemployment and they're going to make more money. Rory.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got my stat ahead of me. So if you're planning in the summer to go to Chessington World of Adventures, you're going to save the grand total of £5 per person. So cheers, Rachel, from accounts. Thank you. Thank you for giving me that £5. Anyways, you asked about tuition.
The national insurance. I'm talking about the Conservatives' idea of cutting it is a very good idea, especially with unemployment, because businesses can hire more people and generate more money at the same time.
Yeah, I'm in total agreement. I think this government is just so stupid. I mean, what do you summarise this government in one word? Absolutely stupid.
Yeah, Tony Blair's Britain actually stood up for people. They were looking at actual public service reform. Think about what he was doing with the NHS. He's prioritising growth over party politics. And Keir Starmer is now so scared of ruining his public image, which has already gone down the drain now, that he's putting... Well, the people of the country second instead of what they're putting the people of the country second and his own party as the number one, when it's so obvious that the people who are working for him, they do not want to be there. Okay, you could hear what Jeremy Hunt was saying, that that politics is a bloodbath. Well, he's not wrong. People are out to get you. Keir Starmer has to realise that his time at number 10 is short. And if he wants to have any sort of... He wants to save his reputation. He has to change something now, whether that's cutting these certain taxes or scrapping net zero for now. And obviously, as you mentioned before, allowing us, the UK, to actually drill in the North Sea ourselves. He needs to send out a statement. The Mandelson files aren't helping. Everything is just making this worse and worse. And this government is completely dysfunctional.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
I think Tony Blair... Mark, bring him in as an advisor as well. Okay, you need some change. What do you think? What do you think about that, Rory?
I mean, look, I think that Tony Blair commands a lot of respect within the Labour Party. He was the only kind of leader to, decisively. I mean, he delivered 13 years of Labour government, and Keir Starmer is probably not even going to succeed six of it. So, I mean, I think Tony Blair's time is. Up. I think his time is
well. He's done his
past. He's done his duty. He's done what he needs to do. And I think, in a similar way to other politicians, I think he should maybe stay out of politics nowadays. But I think interesting parallel is that obviously you saw in 2023 that Conservative reshuffle. You saw David Cameron come back as Foreign Secretary. So I'm not suggesting that Tony Blair should come back.
I mean, Rishi Sunak it's not really a panic. I mean, he's sort of just looking at who's been successful. I think David Cameron was a very credible public speaker.
He won,
really,
in terms of two elections.
Presenting his ideas.
He won
yeah.
two elections. He survived a coalition government. He actually won a surprise majority in the second election. And he managed to fend off not only Scottish independence, but also like voting reform. Maybe he was unlucky
Brexit.
On the third time unlucky for him on the Brexit referendum.
Yeah.
But I think he's a very formidable politician, I think, in a similar way Tony Blair is. And I'm not suggesting at all that Tony Blair should get some sort of cabinet role, he should be made a lord. I don't know if he's a lord, I don't think he is a lord.
I don't think he is,
I think he's just Sir Tony Blair. But anyways, I think that if you want an advisor, I think Tony Blair would be a good advisor. But I think you're almost... It's weird because Keir Starmer always appoints people that have gone on record against him, like Harriet Harman, for instance. She's going on electoral dysfunction, or she's been going on electoral dysfunction for the past year and a half now. And she's been very much, not against Keir Starmer, but quite sceptical of what he's doing, particularly in the last few months. Now she's been given a job. I think Gordon Brown's made some slight, very subtle criticisms, and now he's been given a job. So... He's almost trying to bribe his enemies into, I don't know, kind of not forgiving him, but serving him. But that's a whole other thing. I can't remember your original question. There was something else I wanted to say as far as Labour is concerned. But maybe it'll come to me. I don't know.
Yeah. But I think... I can't remember it, to be honest, either.
Something about... Okay, I'll forget it.
What did you think it was?
Well, what were you just talking about? Because I've been saying... We spoke about... Zero.
Yeah, I was talking about...
Oh, tuition fees. Sorry, business. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. That was it, yeah.
No, I think I totally agree, and this is not, like, politically motivated, but the government does not raise money. Like, you don't tax the government. You tax businesses. Why do you tax businesses? Because businesses produce money, and I don't think we should be constricting businesses
to only hire a certain number of people.
Well, exactly. Really. I think you need an idiot to realize that if unemployment numbers are going up, maybe it's because that you put in a policy that made it harder for people to employ people or even to let people keep their jobs. I don't know. That's just something that everyone thought about 18 months ago, but maybe Rachel Reeves hasn't got the memo. I think it's quite stupid, but I totally agree with the mantra and the politicians who say, oh yeah, it's business that produces growth. It totally is. I mean, as I said, you don't tax government because government doesn't make the money. It's business that you tax because they make the money. It's the same for private individuals.
Yeah. I do think, though, that these people obviously go to these maybe top-level universities, even maybe less known universities. They get their degree, and then we mentioned before about cutting welfare, but I think a lot of the unemployment is not only down to people not being able to get jobs, people not wanting to get jobs, because the new generation has lost this ambition and desire to work and make money, wouldn't you say? Especially because people make their money and then they think, okay, I'm going to get taxed 50% here.
Well, I think
I think in general, people don't want to work anymore because they realize the government are just going to not like take all the money they have, but they're going to take a significant amount of what you earn. And especially when you see how many people are benefiting off the welfare system, they realize they could get a piece of that too as well. So I think Labour needs to have that crackdown as well and tell people that you need to get into work, you need to cut welfare and cut national insurance.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, welfare is an entirely different thing. But I think you're seeing that the government, and this is an analogy people have been saying, like the rider's getting heavier than the horse. But I think that it's got to the point where, and I think particularly for welfare, this is something that I've already spoken about before, but if you're putting more people into welfare, for example, unemployment benefits, not only do you have to actually pay those people to actually give them universal credit and everything, so you're taking away money, but they're also not generating any money. So it's actually a net negative. And that is obviously, I mean, I'm not an economist myself, but that's not economically productive in any way. So you almost want people to get out of work and back into work. And not only will you not have to pay money to them anymore, but actually they'll give money to you because they're producing income and revenue. I think you're seeing a lot of legislation like national insurance that are preventing people from doing that. But I think it's becoming more of a lifestyle choice now, where people are now becoming less motivated to work because they know that they've got nice, not easy life, for instance, but they've got a feasible, practical other option of not working and just getting handouts from the government to pay for your food or whatever. So that's my personal take on welfare. I think it needs to be cut because, like, I mean, ideally, you want everyone to have welfare. You want everyone to have lower taxes. You also want a Dubai situation where no one pays taxes. You've got really good services. I mean, everything's okay, but that's just not how economics works. I mean, it's very much it's very much where one, a positive on one side is a negative on the other. Like, you have to have a balanced budget. And I think there have been problems with that in the past, and we won't get into it. But it's quite funny how Rachel Reeves wanted to do that, but she just had to tax the industries where actually the data that she might have got doesn't include the actual consequences. Like, oh yes, so if I raise national insurance by X amount, that will generate me Y amount of pounds, Y amount of billion pounds. But actually, you're going to lose Z
because
amount of billion
company
pounds.
Because the company is not as productive anymore.
Because those employees are not generating money and you're actually paying them because they're out of work and they need to live because they're basic rights. So she's only looked at what's on paper. She's not looked at the practicalities of anything. And I think that's exactly what you've seen with the Labour Party. And I think it's disrespectful to the people that elected them there. But I think it's just paints politicians in a bad light. I mean, I know, well, I don't know personally, but I'm sure there are a lot of politicians that actually go into Parliament to do a good job for their communities, not just people who are... I'm not suggesting in any way that the government is not bearing in mind their communities or not working for their communities, but I don't think they're paying enough attention or actually kind of taking the job as seriously as they should.
But looking at the logistics and the, as you mentioned before, the practical approach and just looking at viewing people almost as numbers on the page.
Yeah.
And I think that almost that dehumanising way of looking at it is not exactly going to help the government, especially within like almost an economic decline and all these different problems now that are facing the Labour Party. Obviously, I don't think that just changing VAT on some summer activities is going to help. So there needs to be a drastic, not like an economic statement. Okay, you want to show intent, really, because people want to see governments that are not pragmatic but willing to take the necessary risks to ensure that people are better off. And you're saying put more money back into people's pockets,
yeah,
because they're able to spend more and then businesses make more money and almost like a multiplier effect in that sense.
Yeah.
So yeah. So now if we talk about the Reform UK comes into this now, I feel like the warning is quite convenient in a lot of the people inside the Labour Party may underestimate this idea of voter dissatisfaction and the idea of Reform's appeal, because obviously now, as we've spoken many times about Labour shifting more into the central areas and how a lot of the people who voted for Brexit now are moving to Reform, because Reform's whole appeal is based around immigration.
Yeah.
And I think Nigel Farage is very clever in the way that he does his marketing, and he's really appealing to what the country seemingly doesn't like or doesn't appreciate to ensure that he gets these votes.
Yeah.
And I think immigration is necessary in the sense that Britain's rich history of immigration allows for economic growth.
Yeah.
But as we've spoken before in the past, just letting illegal immigrants flood the streets really is especially not going to help, especially with competition for jobs now and obviously this increasing unemployment.
Yeah.
So I think Reform's appeal is working a lot with the country, and you've seen that from these local council results. Roy, do you think that, well, Nigel Farage now, not almost celebrating, but he's really thinking here that I might, because obviously you think that the local council elections only, as in, okay, Lib Dems did really well, but we've spoken before about how the Lib Dems often underperform at these general elections,
yeah,
and how it doesn't often show voter intent.
No.
Do you think that Nigel Farage is now thinking that Reform have a really good shot now, especially at this next general election, of really gaining? Would you say it?
Yeah, I think obviously I'd be surprised if Reform don't make gains at the next election. I maintain my position that I don't think they'll probably become the largest party in government. I'm optimistic that the Conservative approach is the one that most people are going to see sense with the most and are going to vote for it. But I think you've seen a lot of consistent, not rhetoric or polling, but there's been a consistent message from Nigel Farage for a number of years of, and not anti-immigration purely, obviously anti-immigration, but of drawing attention away from maybe Brexit, or he's always advocated for Brexit, for national sovereignty, those sort of things. And I think...
No, of course the party was UKIP, wasn't it?
So I think now you're seeing a real, almost as if those political decisions that he's made are really paying off nowadays. And I think he has a remarkable, or Reform UK, and maybe even UKIP, has a remarkable way or an ability in which they can unite the most conservative places of the home counties in, I don't know, Essex, for example, and the most Labour towns and cities in the north of England, for example, Wigan, where they both really swept those elections last May. So I think by being able to combine those two electoral groups, I mean, it's quite easy to make it up to 326. But I think that there will be too much baggage, not too much baggage, but I think too many things will hit Reform to the point where they are unable to project that message or project that kind of
I mean, they've already
that yeah. they're the most trusted.
I mean, they've already started having their own not little problems, but internal.
You saw Ben Habib, not Ben Habib, sorry, Zia Yusuf and Rob Jenrett carrying their little spat over immigration policy. So maybe that's
so it's already started. I mean, you talk about Nigel Farage obviously receiving that, you know, the gift of his 5 million. Am I right in saying
his shady 5 million?
He didn't. Well, he bought a house and he never really told anyone where he got the money from.
No, exactly.
So if you can't trust him with that, how can you trust him with the country? I mean, that's just a thought. That might not 100%. Be.
Also, him saying it's all about security. Please refer me to these security guards. They must be amazing if you're paying them £5 million. Anyways.
And just to wrap up, now like just a final point. I think the real question or the real statement to really take away here is it's not just about whether Tony Blair is right or wrong. It's whether Britain now in 2026 still responds to Blairite answers or whether the country has fundamentally changed and whether, as we mentioned before, does Tony Blair's criticism, is it as credible as it could have once been, especially with a polarised party system now and the way that the world is changing, that we've got two wars happening right now and there could be even more in the future, really. I do think that just taking away from this now, that these comments are going to be really significant over the next coming weeks.
Yeah.
Thank you, Rory. Lovely to have you in the studio and hopefully see you in a few weeks' time.
See you in a few weeks' time for our next episode.
Yes. So this afternoon, we've looked beyond the headlines surrounding Tony Blair's intervention, because what appeared to be a debate about simply net zero quickly became something much bigger. A debate about growth, about political strategy, about Labour's future as a party, and ultimately about whether Britain's governing class still understands the electorate that it hopes to govern. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Ballot in our penultimate episode of the year. See you next time as we end with a yearly recap. Thank you and goodbye.